Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick, and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up in a few moments, spotlight on the figure of Pope Pius XII, and our weekly rendezvous with our popular Latin lover. Well, thanks very much for joining me once again. As I mentioned a moment ago, I'll be shining the spotlight on the figure of Pope Pius XII. Eugenio Pacelli, elected as successor of Peter on the 2nd of March 1939, and who died on the 9th of October 1958, and indeed has gone down in history as the War Pope, one about whom much ink has been spilt and many comments made. Comments like this one.
Sappiamo che la figura di Eugenio Pacelli è al centro di accese polemiche.
For many decades, Eugenio Pacelli, Pope Pius XII, has been at the heart of a heated controversy. This Roman pontiff, who led the Church in the horrific years of the Second World War and successively the Cold War, is the victim of a black legend.
Un uomo di chiesa che per la sua santità personale risplende come un luminoso testimone.
Those are the words of the Vatican's Secretary of State, Cardinal Tarcisio Bertone, at the presentation of a book by the title of Pius XII, Eugenio Pacelli. A man on the throne of Peter. By Italian author Andrea Tornielli. Cardinal Bertone there was referring to the accusations that in the years that went from 1939 to 1958, this wartime pontiff had been allegedly silent, both about the Holocaust and indeed about Hitler. Cardinal Bertone insisted on this occasion that it is out of place to accuse him of silence.
Sulla figura e l'opera di Papa Pio XII.
The wartime pope had chosen a prudent profile, acting within the limits of the circumstances imposed on him.
The Cardinal Secretary of State also listed numerous papers and documents which, once made available, will reveal the true face of Pius
XII.
And when requested more specifically about the documents in the Vatican's secret archives, he commented,
"Noi abbiamo un bel pool di studiosi sia nell'archivio segreto Vaticano sia."
There's a wealth of material there to be tidied up. But to make it available to scholars, this work in progress must be carried out by experts. I believe we will go ahead very quickly.
This press conference came on the heels of the Vatican's Congregation for the Causes of the Saints voting in favor of a decree recognizing Pius XII's heroic virtues. A decree representing a major hurdle in a long process towards sainthood that began in 1967. But picking up on this alleged silence of Pius XII, I'd now like you to stay tuned as I step back in time together with a group of guests, both religious and lay, all of whom personally met Eugenio Pacelli as Pope and sometimes even before that. I've also been dipping into our Vatican radio archives, finding for you sound from his radio messages in Italian, but also exclusive sound in the English language. Stay tuned then as I bring you the sound of St. Peter's Square when Pius XII was first elected.
Sancte Romane Ecclesie Cardinalem Pacelli.
March 2, 1939, Pope Pius XII, Eugenio Pacelli, was elected as successor of Peter. Germany was quick to react. The very next day, the Berliner Morgenpost, a Nazi propaganda paper, wrote,
"The election of Cardinal Pacelli is not accepted with favour in Germany because he was always opposed to Nazism."
Six months later, the world was at war, and the new Pope was making a last desperate appeal for peace through the microphones of Vatican Radio.
Minaccio è il pericolo, ma è ancora tempo. Nulla è perduto con la pace. Tutto può esserlo con la guerra.
Nothing is lost with peace. Everything could be lost with war.
Trattando con buona volontà e con rispetto dei reciproci diritti, si accorgeranno dai sinceri.
Less than a month after the outbreak of the Second World War, Pius XII published his first encyclical, Summi Pontificatus, on the unity of human society. In the encyclical, the new Pope branded racial prejudice as the most pernicious of modern errors and condemned, quote, the forgetfulness of that law of human solidarity dictated by the equality of rational nature in all persons to whatever people they belong, unquote. On October the 28th, 1939, in Britain, the Times commented on the encyclical under the headline, New Idolatry Condemned. And across the Atlantic, the New York Times carried an almost identical headline.
Pope condemns persecution.
The New York Times editorial ran as follows.
The voice of Pius XII is a lonely voice in the silence and darkness enveloping Europe this Christmas. He is about the only ruler left on the continent of Europe who dares to raise his voice at all.
Si sentiranno grandi della vera grandezza, imponendo silenzio alle voci della passione.
With this kind of documented, dated evidence, how is it that the memory of Pius XII is still marred by criticism and accusations that not only did he fail to condemn the Nazi ideology, but that he was silent over the murder of 6.5 million Jews? Listen now to the Pope's first Christmas message addressed to the world at war on Christmas Eve 1939.
Questa guerra mondiale e tutto ciò che le si connette si tratti dei precedenti remoti o prossimi o dei suoi procedimenti.
The world seems to have forgotten Christ's message of peace, the voice of reason, of Christian brotherhood. We have had to witness acts that are irreconcilable with international law, with the principles of human rights, and with the most basic human sentiments. I refer to the premeditated aggression of a minority of hard-working and peaceful people, to the atrocities committed against non-combatants, refugees, the aged, women and children, acts which cry out to God for vengeance.
Queste serie di azioni contrastanti con lo spirito umano e cristiano. Le convenzioni internazionali per rendere meno.
Esta ex in un Landein! Esta ex in Soldaten begrüßen!
And then, as the horror of the war became more explicit, Pope Pius XII too became more explicit in his condemnation of the atrocities. Again, it was Christmas, and the war had been raging for 3 years.
Questo voto l'umanità lo deve agli innumerevoli morti che giacciono sepolti nei campi di guerra. Il sacrificio della loro vita nel compimento del loro dovere è l'olocausto.
Hundreds of thousands of persons, through no fault of their own, sometimes only for reasons of nationality or race, are destined to death or to a gradual extinction.
And once again, Germany was quick to react. The Gestapo, Hitler's feared police force, issued a report on that message, which was delivered to the Führer himself. This is what it read.
In a manner never known before, the Pope has repudiated the National Socialist New European Order. It is true, the Pope does not refer to the National Socialists in Germany by name, but his speech is one long attack on everything we stand for. Here, he is clearly speaking on behalf of the Jews.
ask you, what kind of race could he have had in mind except the Jews? You see, everybody understood this perfectly well, and especially the Nazi authorities understood that, as did the fascist authorities, and there were many protests about this.
Jesuit Father Peter Gumpel, relator for the cause of canonization of Pius XII, knew him personally.
Of these messages, understood it perfectly well. I said those who were able, because the Vatican radio at the time had a very weak transmission, and it was not easy to capture it. Of course, in Germany, foreign newspapers could not be published. Listening to foreign radios during the war was punishable by death, so many of the statements of the Pope couldn't reach the German public. But I have lived in Germany under Hitler, at least till 1939, and every Catholic knew exactly what the Catholic Church, the bishops, and the Pope were thinking about the persecution of Jews. I think Pius XII did everything he could possibly do to save Jews, and many Jews have admitted that, and Jewish historians and others.
Albert Einstein was one prominent member of the Jewish community who was quick to recognize Pius XII's courage in speaking out against the Nazi ideology. He said as much in an article published in Time magazine in 1940.
Being a lover of freedom, when the revolution came in Germany, I looked to the universities to defend it, knowing that they had always boasted of their devotion to the cause of truth. But no, the universities immediately were silenced. Then I looked to the great editors of the newspapers, whose flaming editorials in days gone by had proclaimed their love of freedom. But they, like the universities, were silenced in a few short weeks. Only the church stood squarely across the path of Hitler's campaign for suppressing truth.
In 1943, Hitler's propaganda chief, Joseph Goebbels, wrote in his diary,
"Again and again, reports reached us that the Pope is feverishly at work during this entire crisis."
Documented testimonies like these are overlooked or blatantly ignored by those who insist on their own one-sided view of history.
And it is a sorry fact that years or so later, the attack was launched against Pius XII, that he, for financial reasons or out of cowardice, or because he was pro-Hitler, did never do anything for the Jews. This is a real falsification of history. Nowadays, many people who write about it, many of these people were not even born. Many of these people have never lived under a political dictatorship and a police state, as we had to live in Germany at that time. And therefore, they are practically, psychologically, not in a position to assess what really went on in Germany and what the possibilities were to do something for people. I think that's the reason. There may be other reasons underneath, because to tell you very frankly, I have talked with a number of Jewish scholars and journalists, and it has been amazing to me that if I asked them whether they ever read or saw or knew about the 11 volumes published by the Vatican on what has happened during the Second World War, a number of them said they had never even heard of it, let alone studied it.
Our first job was to get out the official publication, namely what is in the archives. But there are many things which are not in the archives and can't be, simply the human drama behind all these papers. So what I would do in the summers and the winters, I would make the rounds of the various archives in Bonn and Koblenz and Berlin and Paris and London and Washington, D.C., where the follow-up of these, the background of these situations are on the record. And so much of this...
Interviews that I've been putting aside over the years.
Foremost expert on the Vatican and World War II spent 14 years researching and writing those 11 volumes. He too knew Pius XII personally.
Downgraded, systematically downgraded. And the four volumes that the Vatican published of the papal relief during the war has been systematically put aside, ignored. Well, now that's not honest. It isn't even moral. But it's certainly a proof that of the partiality of the type of propaganda that we've been reading in the press for a good number of years now. The series is known as the victims of the war. And it was not really in Rome. There was a lot about Rome, but also the things what happened in Poland and in Russia and in Germany and in France also, in terms of the the predicament of the poor innocent victims of the war.
Today, the millions of suffering children are looking with appealing eyes to the vicar of Jesus. Let them come to us. Let no one hold them off. We love them all with the love of Christ, and we cannot rest so long as the pangs of hunger make them cry out for help.
Some people who lived during the war, felt that if Pope Pius XII had spoken out more loudly, the Catholics would have been persecuted after the Jews.
I am perfectly convinced, first of all, that Pope Pius XII would have received absolutely nothing in the way of saving Jews if he had spoken out. That is the first thing to be said. And there are several arguments to substantiate this fact. He seriously considered to do so. And in his Christmas elocution and elsewhere, he spoke about the illegitimacy and the evil to persecute people just on account of their religion and their race. And I said already that everybody understood, at least also the people who knew about it, and the Nazi authority and the fascist authorities complained about these allusions that the Pope made there. He did not mention the term Jews, but that because the term Jew worked as a red cloth on Hitler, and it would have aggravated the situation. And I am personally convinced, having lived under Hitler and having studied these things for many years now, that any public statement of the Pope not only would not have saved a single Jewish life, but would have aggravated the situation of the Jews, and at the same time would have caused an even severer persecution of the Roman Catholic Church, and thus have prevented so many Catholics to help Jews in all secrecy. And this has been done, and unfortunately, in contemporary literature, is belittled or simply ignored or glossed over, and as if this had not happened.
I hope you enjoyed that exclusive sound from our Vatican Radio archives, in particular the voice of Pope Pius XII. For your information, I'll soon be bringing you a similar program, focusing this time on this wartime Pope's humanitarian efforts. And now hold tight as I change the pace and mood of the program and join my popular Latin lover. He's Carmelite Father Reginald Foster. Father Foster, I want to speak about a sleeping beauty. A sleeping beauty, which is the church of Santa Costanza, or the mausoleum of Santa Costanza.
Oh, here.
It was a sleeping beauty for many years, wasn't it?
What does that mean? Why? Because it was...
Because it was a beautiful place that was in ruins. In the sense that it was a sleeping beauty.
Dormiens Pulchra.
Dormiens Pulchra.
Oh, Pulchra Dormiens, a beautiful woman sleeping. What do you want to say?
That church is connected to Constantine, right? It's dedicated to Constantia. Constantia, the daughter of Constantine, no?
Mm-hmm. And Constans, too, also his son there. And
do you speak about that sort of thing with your students, Santa Costanza? Or...
No, I don't. I mean, there's so much to talk about, I don't. I don't, every once in a while something will come up, but there's too much to talk about.
But,
and we're supposed to talk about the Latin language in school, not fairy tales, although we had suggestion box, no? And one of the students, there were a few suggestions at the end of the first semester. We want more stories. Said, friends, this is not time for stories. They like my stories, you know. I said, no more stories. Latin.
Well, I want a story today. I remember once you took me around the Colosseum and we had an appointment, and you told me the appointment is at the Arch of Septimius Severus.
In the Forum.
Yeah.
Not Constantine, in the Forum. Okay, go on.
In the Forum. Instead of which, it was at the Arch of Titus, You had...
Oh, that's on the other side. Okay.
You had told me it was a slip of your...
Oh.
And so I was waiting somewhere and you were waiting somewhere else. But the arch we were supposed to speak about was linked to the Emperor Constantine, right?
Well, that's the third arch down below.
Mm-mm.
The Emperor Constantine and then Titus and Septimius Severus are the three big ones in the forum.
The three arches.
Mm-hmm.
And so which one is linked to Constantine?
Well, I mean, down below is Constantine. He put together, he got pieces from different monuments and he put together this whole thing in honor of himself. Mm-hmm. And there's the glorious inscription by divine instinct. You know,
Divinus?
Yeah, I think it was Instinctu Divino.
Instinctu Divino.
That he conquered his enemies, Maxentius, you know.
The Pontemiria.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's all on the inscription there.
At any rate, there's a sacred road there, no? Sacra Via.
Via Sacra.
Via Sacra.
That went today, like, from the Colosseum way up to the Capitoline Hill was the Via Sacra.
And it was a narrow road, no?
Oh, yeah. Well, of course, they all were. But because they had certain events took place there, Romulus and Tatius made the city of Rome, and they had the house of the high priest was on the Via Sacra, and the Vestal Virgins, the Via Sacra. And
their eternal fire.
Yes, exactly. And you probably saw in the newspapers about 2 weeks ago, they discovered a whole new complex below the ground on the Via Sacra that goes back to about 400 BC.
Every single one of those monuments dates back to a different era. For example, a Roman, say, of 100 BC would have seen a different forum to the one of 200.
I always, whenever I take people around, I say, friends, what you see here, of course, Cicero didn't see, Virgil didn't see. This is all later or earlier and everything else. For example, the Colosseum. If you figure the Colosseum as 80 after Christ, got the idea, huh? I mean, Virgil, Caesar, Cicero, no one ever saw this thing. And they say, the Colosseum has been standing here since Cicero's time. No. But see, you have to have your history organized. That's how I got into a little bit of history. I don't like history. But you have to know where you stand, you know. I mean, Septimius Severus is 200 A.D. Got the idea? And Titus, you see, is 79 A.D. This is 150 years there. Most tourists or most people coming just have no idea of history.
And then Septimius Severus was the
father of Caracalla and Jeta.
Because they're the thermal baths of Caracalla.
Caracalla, certainly, and Septimius Severus. And certainly, if you look at the arch there, you see in the third line was taken out by Caracalla because there was mention of Jeta, his brother. Well, his brother got kind of liquidated.
Why?
Well, of course, they couldn't get on enough. And so Caracalla has this glorious inscription, and it just kind of says, to these wonderful men, which is to his father and to himself. And the other brother, Jeta, is cut out. And you can see the different stone on the arch, if you're careful. They replaced the stone. They just took off the whole line.
I think that Caracalla was a wonderful person because he built all those thermal baths. My dream in life is to restore the baths of Caracalla. How'd you say that? My dream in life is to restore the baths of Caracalla.
Somnium meum ut terme Caracalla restaurentur. Somnium meum in vita est ut Caracalla terme restaurentur.
What's your dream in life?
No, I have no dreams anymore. I'm fulfilled.
What? No, your dream in life is to have Latin.
Well, I would like to see the tradition continue.
Mm.
of Latin, which it is. I mean, I just wrote today, I think, the 100th letter, a 100th person wrote to me about summer school.
What do they write to you?
Well, they write, I want to come to summer school, and I heard about your summer school. I want to come, and I send them a packet, an entrance exam. Said, if you take the entrance exam, I'll decide whether you're going to come to summer school or not. So I've admitted about 30 people out of about 65 or 70.
So you're very strict, aren't you?
Oh, sure. And today I wrote and I said, no, I don't know, my dear friend, this is kind of bad, but kind of discouraging the man. Well, let him go, see what happens. But I mean, the interest in Latin is absolutely phenomenal. I won't say keep them out. I can't beat them back.
How do you say beat them back?
Okay, okay. Repellere, refringere. Non possum eos repellere, refringere. But in the church, it's dead. Sad to say. The clerics and stuff and church institutions, they're not interested in this. Well,
if I'm not mistaken, till not very long ago, the Vatican diplomatic corps, the school there, the Accademia, the lessons were in Latin, weren't they?
Well, I mean, other than the lessons, I mean, they had to know that. They were supposed to know Latin. And even our credentials, I mean, the Pope's credentials that he sends with ambassadors around the world are still in Latin. I mean, the Pope will write in Latin to Queen Elizabeth or Gaddafi, and we write in Latin.
But does he send a translation as
well? Well, I don't know what they do.
The British
don't accept the Latin. And so we send the credentials up to London, huh? For Queen Elizabeth, and then up in London, those people, our men up in London, have to make it an official translation into English because the British don't accept Latin at all.
How many letters have you written to heads of state?
Oh, my Lord, hundreds or thousands, I don't even know. I mean, over 36 years, I don't even know. To everybody. To George Bush, to Reagan, to Clinton. Certainly when the ambassador of the Vatican goes to Washington, they present their credentials in Latin. And of course, the people, and I've gotten personal messages. They say, Foster, will you please keep the thing simple? Because we're having problems down at the delegation in Washington translating the thing into English. I said, well, that's your problem. You're supposed to know Latin.
How do you say that's your problem?
Vesta difficultas est. Porte scire vos Latine.
What's so obscure about your Latin, do you think?
Well, it's not obscure. It's just beautiful. I mean, not beautiful. I don't say beautiful. I mean, it's very nice and formal and elegant and za, za, za. And it's not that my Latin is difficult. It's that they don't know Latin. That's the problem.
A huge thank you there to our popular Latin lover. He's Carmelite father, Reginald Foster, and he's currently working in the Vatican as the Pope's own Latinist. And that brings us up to time. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. Be sure to check out our website. The address is www.vaticanradio.org. Laudetur Jesus Christus.